Welcome to episode 19 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Loving Hope. First, the news. Hopefully, most of you saw that I had an op-ed supporting the First Step Act published in the Crime Report. If you missed it, I'll include a link in the notes. Also, as you might have seen, I started a dedicated site for the show. It's called decarcerationnation.com. Check it out. You can find pictures, the show notes, links to all of the research that we quote in the show, all kinds of stuff. And if you leave comments, as long as they're civil, I will definitely respond. Okay, this episode is about the calls for clemency for Matthew Charles. Let's get right to my interview with Kevin Ring. Recently, there have been a lot of people calling for President Donald J. Trump to commute the sentence of Mr. Matthew Charles, who spent over 20 years in prison, was released, and was readjusting very well. But it turned out that his release was an error, and he was forced to go back to prison after the error was discovered. I wanted to find someone to talk about the Mr. Charles situation, and I could think of nobody better than Kevin Ring, who, among other things, started the Change.org petition calling for Mr. Charles' commutation. Kevin Ring is currently the president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums, a former Capitol Hill legislative aide, former executive director of the Republican Study Committee, and a former lobbyist. He is the author of Scalia's Court, A Legacy of Landmark Decisions and Dissents, a graduate of Syracuse University, and of the Columbia School of Law at Catholic University. And like me, Kevin is also formerly incarcerated. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Would you mind sharing a little bit of Mr. Matthew's story and the story of how you decided to get involved?
Sure. The case came to my attention in December of last year, end of the year last year, because of the reporting of Julieta Martinelli from NPR in Nashville. And she came across this case where Matthew Charles, a 51-year-old man, was being... There was the debate about whether he should be sent back to prison. What happened is he had committed a number of crimes when he was younger, went to prison, state prison, came out, and then he got convicted of trafficking crack cocaine. So he got a long sentence because of the what people thought was because of the excessive mandatory sentences that applied to crack sentences, to crack cocaine dealing. And he got a 35-year prison sentence. And in 2010, Congress had passed the Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentences. The Sentencing Commission made those changes relevant to the guidelines and then made the guideline changes retroactive. FAM, as you may or may not know, sends emails into the federal prisons, keeps them updated on legal and legislative updates. Mr. Charles got our note about the Sentencing Commission's action, filed a pro se motion to court saying, hey, this guideline change should apply to me because I'm here for a crack sentence. The court took up his case and said, you're right. You have a 35-year sentence. You should be out earlier than that. We should cut your sentence by over a decade and send him home. The Obama Justice Department appealed and said he was not in there for 35 years because of his crack sentence. He was there because of his prior offenses that qualified him to be a career offender. And that's why he was there. And so you're in error in releasing him. That went up to the circuit court. Circuit court agreed with the Justice Department. And so they were ready to order him back to prison. Now the Trump administration took over. There was a new U.S. attorney, a new judge who was ready to impose the sentence and send him back. And she was troubled by this because he had now been out of prison for a year and a half and had gotten back on his feet. And she said to the Justice Department, the new U.S. attorney, do you really want to do this? Because he seems to have rehabilitated himself. You might want to just drop these charges or something. And she didn't say that specifically, but she said, look for a way to find relief for this man. And the Justice Department said, we'll take it under advisement. Of course, they ignored it, and they sent him back. So I had seen this reporting, and while it was still being decided whether they should send him back or not, I wrote an article saying, let's be clear, the prosecutors have a discretion here. They could choose not to. They could drop these charges. It's not surprising that they chose not to, especially in this administration. And so he was sent back. So we were following this case. The most recent report that came out last week was a report talking about him turning himself back in on May 14th. And a lot of people read that story. It was flying around the internet. And I knew Pham would get involved because we already had been. And I thought, while we're doing this, since there's so much sort of grassroots appeal as what on this human interest story, let's try to galvanize the public in some way. I just started this petition just so people, when they said, what can we do? We'd do that. And it took off. I mean, this is a case that has struck people on both sides of the political aisle like nothing I've seen in, I mean, at least 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive, the response. And I thought that earlier today I saw a long thread you put out on Twitter that sort of suggested some reasons why this is a contextually uniquely important case in a lot of ways. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I really want Matthew Charles to get relief because he deserves it and he doesn't need to be in prison. But I don't want this case to come across as a one-off or for people to think that his case is so unique. What was unique about his case was that he was let out early at all. And so we got a chance to see him in flesh and blood, see his rehabilitation, and see him make something of his life. So that's what was different. Otherwise, he would have languished like thousands of others do without any publicity. And the other thing that was important to me was I was hearing people talk about his 35-year sentence for, you know, we hear this nonviolent low-level drug offense. And yes, the crack sentences were bad. Yes, they contributed to his long sentence. But that's not what drove his sentence, as I said. What drove his sentence is what was his earlier offenses. And those offenses included violent offenses. He was convicted of kidnapping his girlfriend, abusing her. He grew up himself in an abusive home. He mimicked that behavior, as many people do. He, you know, fled a police department when he had been arrested for those offenses. He carjacked somebody. And then in trying, there was a struggle there and a gun went off. And the person was shot in the head. Luckily, it grazed his head, but that person could have just as easily died. And so I was worried, or I thought there was a teachable moment here based on the fact that, you know, people who don't otherwise care about criminal justice, don't know a lot of ins and outs about sentencing, were grasping on this case of, oh, 35 years to this gentlemanly old man. He looks like Santa Claus, and he's got this gentle demeanor and a slow gait, and he's in his 50s, he's a grandfather. But I wanted people to understand this is a violent offender. This is somebody who committed violent crimes in a Me Too era, was abusive to women. And I just think if people could understand that and still find him worthy of redemption and of a second chance, that would make this story even more powerful. And I think that the way things work for people is once they embrace him, once they saw his picture, once they heard his story and saw what he was doing now, that no amount of backstory was going to dissuade them from that. And so once they bought into the fact that this guy didn't need to go to prison, it didn't matter what he did earlier. But so I think all the more reason it was important to tell them what he did do earlier, because that might open their mind and hearts to other people who they otherwise wouldn't hear about.
And in that thread, you raised a couple of things that I've talked about quite a bit, one of which is the notion of aging out of violence. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, some of these issues that his case raises are known to sentencing nerds and criminologists and people who have nothing better to do but think about this stuff like you and me. But to, you know, it's not obvious to lay people that people age out of crime. I mean, once you say that, and once you say there's data that proves that, it obviously makes some sense to them. You know, robbery and carjacking, that's a young man's game. And so I think people can appreciate that point, but I think it was worth explaining that this is a guy whose behavior had changed. And so the data proves that, you know, that's a steep curve. You know, the violent crimes are committed, you know, 18 to 23 or 25, and then it starts going down. And by, you know, 50, it's nothing. And so,
and he's a, yeah. Mr. Charles is a great example of that,
yes.
Because his, all the crimes that you talked about that were, would be labeled violent were things that happened a long time ago. In this last prison stint, he was a model prisoner, correct?
Yeah. So what happened was after his state stint, and then he got caught with the crack cocaine, he was getting ready to be sentenced for that. And another person who was either leaving prison or also on getting ready to be sentenced gave him a Bible. This was a guy who admits he was a bad person in his 20s, very hardened by his upbringing, grew up in the projects, and again, with an abusive father. And, you know, I think he had something of a conversion. And I think people are skeptical about that. I can be skeptical about that sometimes too. But his deeds over the course of the next 5 years bore that out. He took a lot of correspondence courses, Bible courses, and became something of a biblical scholar. He became a law clerk. He pursued a college degree. He mentored others. He filed motions on behalf of others and himself. And like I said, we know from Pham's interaction, even though we didn't know him at the time, that he was getting our emails and using those to file motions on his own behalf and others. And, you know, in the course of 21 years in prison, didn't have one infraction. And you and I know better than others that that's a long time to not run afoul. I mean, it's not only a long time to not do something wrong. It's a long time to not have some, you know, jerk of a guard just claim you did something wrong, or for friends or buddies to implicate you in doing something wrong. So, I mean, it's almost miraculous to have such a spotless record for 21 years, but it speaks to his rehabilitation. And, you know, I serve with people who, we're doing 10-year sentences or the rest, and I would see him in year 6 or 7, and I'd say, oh, gosh, that's a long sentence. He said, no, I had to come. I mean, I had a chip on my shoulder. I needed this, and I'm done. I've put away those sort of childish things, but they needed that. And he was somebody who clearly needed that too, which speaks to the role of prison, I think, for some people. But he was past that, well past that. And thank goodness for the quirk that let him out, so now everybody else knows it.
Yeah, and when he was out, he was doing quite well, correct?
Yeah, so he gets out. He rents a room. He's volunteering at a food pantry, and the people there take to him. He's this sort of soft-spoken, quiet guy. And he's there because a lot of people who are on parole and probation are working in these volunteer jobs, and they come in and out, but he's coming every Saturday, and they learn that they can depend on him. And he meets a woman he falls for, and they strike up a relationship. And, you know, I mean, that's important too. That's grounding. And for somebody who's been in prison 21 years, you know, that's something of a feat too. And the data also shows that if you're going to reoffend, the most dangerous year is that first one. So the fact that he got through a year and a half and got himself right was really positive. And he said, I had a minimum wage job. I mean, he wasn't living in luxury, but he felt so good about himself that he was doing things the right way. It's almost miraculous because he had never done things the right way. So this isn't being born again or getting a second chance. In some ways, this was a first chance.
Yeah, and when he was told that he had to go back, he had a pretty positive outlook about even that, which is amazing. Do you feel like it seems like part of what you're saying, I think, in most of the stuff that I've read that you talk about this, is that he, in a way, is a stand-in for a lot of people in prison who got long sentences and who are considered in some ways unredeemable because of the word violence. Did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I definitely think that the violence, nonviolence distinction does not have as much meaning as it does, again, except for the public and elected officials. I mean, sort of where the culture is on this is we're willing to let go or let slide certain things done in the name of nonviolent offenders, but not violent offenders. And it doesn't take long to push back on that to say, what about a bar fight between somebody who found out his, you know, wife was cheating with this guy versus somebody who sold drugs, you know, 15 times and keeps targeting kids? I mean, one is certainly more dangerous and it's not the violent one. But that, you know, that clear distinction is easy for the public and elected officials to sort of stand behind. And President Obama himself during his clemency initiative said he had tended to have little sympathy for violent offenders. So I get that because people think of rapists and murderers and Al-Qaeda and stuff. And so I get that. But it's not a great distinction. And even recidivism data, you know, it doesn't back up the idea that violent offenders are more likely to reoffend because of what we talked about, aging out. And so, again, his case raises that issue that I think is important to use to teach people. I'm one of those who, in my time in prison, I was in a camp, I wasn't in a medium or high, and I'm not going to pretend to see things, but I don't like to romanticize the prison population. I met a lot of jerks and dumb people and people who deserve to be in prison. They earn their way there. I don't think everyone there is Gandhi or Mandela. But I also think that just because I don't want them at a dinner party doesn't mean they should be living in cages the rest of their life. And with no parole and sort of no look back provision in our sentencing law, we're not able to figure out the Matthew Charleses from the guys who are incorrigible. And so, I mean, that's a problem to me. And I think it's not that I think there's a million Matthew Charleses, but I think there's a lot and I think they're worth saving. And so I think that's worth addressing.
Just a little question about that, because I also obviously met a lot of people that I wouldn't necessarily invite to a dinner party when I was in prison. But at the same time, I met an awful lot of people who seemed just as surprised that they were capable of what they did as anyone else would have been. Would you say that, you know, while there are certainly, I mean, was your experience uniquely a lot of people who were incorrigible, or would you say it was a good mix where you were at too? Because it was definitely a pretty strong mix where I was.
No, I would say, look, I thought about a third of the people I was with didn't need to be there or could be gone soon. I saw a third of the people who I was pretty worried that not long after they were going to be there, that they might be getting in some sort of trouble. A third may be high. I saw a third of people that I think they wanted to get to the right place. And I even think more programming and more mentoring and more hands-on services and things that the prison could have provided might have made a difference. So no, it's not that I thought that most were incorrigible. It's just, and the other thing about this is it's hard to say. I try to tell this to people. What I did growing up playing football and Little League and doing those things is because that's what my peer group did. I mean, I'd like to say that, you know, the path I chose early in life was a moral one because I'm a fantastic person. But you know, we know, I have kids. I know that they're driven a lot by who their friends are, and I was too. And so the guys I was meeting with, I mean, it's almost like I don't think they thought they had a choice. I mean, I think they did what they did because that's what the friends in their neighborhood did. And that's what their peer groups did. And I don't know if they were surprised to get in trouble, but they were certainly surprised at the trouble they got themselves in terms of like their sentences, which goes to the issue of deterrence. I mean, I don't think any of these guys thought, I'm consciously running the risk of doing something that could get me 10 years in prison, right? They might have known that they were straddling a line, but they didn't think that they were doing something worthy of such long sentences. I bet Matthew Charles was the same thing. He just, you know, he was in a bad place. He was doing things he knew was wrong, but he wasn't weighing those cost benefits out. And so, again, I think when I hear narratives, I get scared. When somebody talks about, you know, I get worried about, you know, in prison, I met a lot of people who had entrepreneurial spirit. Obviously, that's how we ran. You know, you paid for tuna for your haircuts. They ran betting pools. The underground economy was there. I loved all that. I love telling people about that. Yeah. And I think that's great. But I think there's people who are advocates who have never been in who act as if everybody in there is a fledgling Bill Gates. And that if they just got the opportunity to get a little seed money, they'd run a company when they get out. And I think more people need to come out and just be a Walmart greeter and just be a cog in a machine and just live an honest lifestyle. That is what we should applaud and help them do and get an education. So I don't like to romanticize the population because I think, you know, there's a lot of people who got there because, you know, they just didn't think right. And I'm not sure that they were going to be much better when they got out. But there's people like Matthew Charles. And I think as long as we allow it to be complicated and that we're not going to get it right, we're not going to have a zero recidivism rate, I'm more comfortable talking about that and saying it's worth taking a chance at some of these people. It's worth changing our systems and processes to find those guys who we can save.
I suspect that's part of the programming call you made earlier is probably part of why you support the First Step Act, I'm guessing.
Yeah, because I went to prison as a lawyer until I got disbarred while I was sitting there. And, you know, educated, I had a house to go back to. I knew I was going to come back to fam. I had a job. But I saw people who weren't sure what they were going to do. And it wasn't just, you know, there's RDAP in the federal prison. There's the residential drug treatment program, and that has a pretty decent record. They should open it up to more people. But I saw people who had anger management problems, who just had, you know, sort of criminal behavior thinking, they call it, you know, that a lot of RDAP is even based on cognitive behavioral therapy, because there's just, you know, problems with delayed gratification and impulse control. And I think those things are teachable. Some of that comes with age, just slowing down. But other times it's just trying to think through, thinking about your thinking, metacognition. And I think, you know, I think those are things that people can do. I think you can teach people marketable job skills. I mean, I'm so glad that like Mike Rowe from Dirty Jobs is an advocate for reentry programs, because if you think about the types of things that this country needs people to do, welding and plumbing and the manufacturing jobs, the ones that haven't gone away yet, I think prisoners are the people would be happy to do those. I mean, because these aren't guys, you know, they're not going to work in the service.
Let's not forget infrastructure, which our country could use a little bit of help with.
Yeah. Yeah. And those aren't minimum wage jobs either. So, I mean, and I saw some of that. I mean, I saw HVAC programs and, you know, and plumbing and electrical work. I just didn't see a lot of them. And I think you could get there through partnerships, public-private partnerships, not closing these compounds off so tightly and acting. I mean, I was at a prison camp, right? So there was no fence around me. I could walk home if I wanted to and risk the escape charge, but so could the other 300 people there, and they didn't. So we're not talking about the worst of the worst. And so the idea that we can't have community colleges or private businesses come on and mentor and partner makes no sense to me. So we're not even talking necessarily about a huge federal investment. So I just think there's things we could do to help those who really do have a skills deficit, you know, get prepared to come back. Because otherwise you're warehousing. And even if you had job skills, they atrophy. I served time, I'm sure you did, with people who, you know, said, what's an app, you know, and they didn't know what the iPhone was, and they didn't, you know. And so I think that's very scary. And it's hard to know unless you've been through it. After a year and a half, when I left, I was disoriented. And these guys who have been for 20 years come out, and I just can't even imagine what the world looks like to them. So I think opening up these compounds so that their life in prison is a little closer to what it's like outside.
It sounded like the petition is doing pretty well. Do you have any recent statistics on how many people have signed?
Yeah. I mean, it was going gang. I mean, it shows you how naive I am about this stuff. I started it, and after it hit 1,000 and 2,000, I'm tweeting out, hey, we just passed 2,000. And I thought, I should shut the hell up, because soon it was 5, 10, 50. You know, now it's at 35,000. And according to the change.org people, it's going to take off because they're going to send it out even more widely. So I think the sky's the limit on it. I think part of it goes to the incredible reporting that was done on this story. You know, fam tells stories. We try to humanize these cases so we can make policy changes. But what Julieta Martinelli did with this story was brilliant, because she was a great storyteller. It was artistry. And not only that, I think her pictures moved people because you got to see who we were talking about. So I think that changed hearts and minds. But this thing has taken off. And I don't know if we've already talked about this, but you've got National Review reporters writing op-eds saying free Matthew Charles. The Federalist website, which is, you know, right of center and can be tough law and order crowd. I was on Breitbart Radio talking about this case. It's just been amazing. And
yeah, I think one of the comments I made earlier in the week was, if you can find something that the Federalist, Breitbart, you and I all agree on, that's probably something that should happen.
Yeah, because I'm such a jackass and I hate being part of a club and I hate unanimity and I have just enough contrarian streak, I felt like while we're all sort of bathing in our own goodness and righteousness, I want everyone to just understand how messy this case is, you know, just because I think it's important so that the next one that comes, we don't forget about it, because it's not as clean seeming as Matthew's case.
Yeah. And I also just think it's important to remember that there's almost always complexity in these cases.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate you taking the time. And it's great to finally talk in person instead of just online.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thanks so much. Talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
Thanks again to Kevin Ring for that great discussion of Matthew Charles. I want to clarify one point of our discussion. I believe virtually everyone I met in prison, with help, support, and access to programming, and when necessary, with therapy and treatment, could come back and live a happy, productive life, much without the violence, without all the problems. I believe everybody deserves a second chance. I think what is really important about that discussion is that part of embracing Mr. Charles' case is coming to grips with the complexities that his case represents. Mr. Charles had a violent and even dangerous past, but demonstrated over a long period of time that he had changed. Time changes people. As John Fath has said, violence is a moment or period of time, not a person. When we try to freeze human beings and define them only by their worst moments, we miss out on a lot, and we miss out on a lot of those people's possibilities. Over time, people change. With time, violence changes. Most importantly, when he came home, when he was finally out of prison and reintegrating, he was a positive person in his community. He was making it work. This is the dream scenario. The best possible outcome for someone coming out of prison is that someone comes home, handles parole and probation with grace, and finds a home, a job, and starts being a positive force in his community. Mr. Charles was doing all of these things. It's not easy to return from prison. You face so much discrimination and so many people trying to trip you up, including a system that seems to be trying to send you back whenever possible. And this is a pretty obvious example of that. Mr. Charles was getting past all of that. And some prosecutor, and let's not mince words here, the prosecutor in this case could have chosen not to pursue returning Mr. Charles to prison. In fact, a judge begged the prosecutor not to pursue sending Mr. Charles back to prison. Anyway, this prosecutor chose to ignore all of the evidence of Mr. Charles' positive prison record, all of the evidence of his positive return to society, all of the evidence of everything he was doing in the community, and they sent Mr. Charles back to prison anyway. Anyone who wonders why I say this podcast is about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system needs to listen to that again. The prosecutor chose to ignore all the evidence and chose to apply the letter of the law despite knowing that a good case existed for ignoring the letter of the law in favor of honoring the spirit of the law. So I see Mr. Matthew Charles as a person who has done all the right things and should come home. I see Matthew Charles as a symbol of everything that is wrong with the absurdly long and inflexible sentences of the failed 30-year experiment with tough-on-crime lawmaking and with tough-on-crime prison construction and prison maintenance. And I see Matthew Charles' case and all the people who have become activated to help push for his commutation as an opportunity for us to start having a more mature and nuanced discussion about how crime works, about how prison works, and about how rehabilitation works. For us to start paying attention to the evidence and stop listening to non-evidence-based scare tactics. It's time for us to start refusing to play patsy in this game and stop supporting whoever is pushing the harshest possible criminal legislation and start opposing these people who seem to only care about what is politically palatable. Unfortunately, criminal justice reform has become a political game. And I believe in this moment, and in cases like Mr. Charles' case, we have the possibility of breaking through to a new politics based on reason and not just fear. As we both mentioned during the interview, if you can get the Federalist, Koch Industries, Cut 50, the ACLU, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, and myself to all agree on anything, it's probably a great idea and should be done. In other words, let's bring Mr. Charles home. So last, but certainly not least, if you have not signed the Change.org petition asking President Trump to commute Matthew Charles' sentence, please do so as soon as possible. I will include a link to the Change.org petition in the notes. Next week, I'll be talking with Katrina Burlett, the former debate coach of the Statesville Correctional Center debate team, whose team was abruptly disbanded by the Illinois Department of Corrections almost immediately after a public debate in front of legislators where the inmates were asking Illinois to restore parole. As always, you can find the show notes at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. That's all one word. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or Stitcher and like us on Spotify. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time.